Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 19th of August, recording at 9:20 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes. But first, let's have a quick review of the week. Well, the typical short-covering sharp rally that one sees in bear markets ended on Monday for most indices, and we've seen further weakness as the week progressed, and that included today. Asian stock market indices were overwhelmingly to the minus side. A big hit in Korea, down over 6%. And we saw the first real downward dynamic in Indonesia today as well. Hang Seng Index down 3%, Nikkei 2.5%, Australia 3.5%. European stock market indices also closed with significant losses, mostly over 2%, although the UK's FTSE was only down 1%. Wall Street closed around the lows of the day. It had opened weak, then recovered, moved to the upside, showing moderate gains, maybe 0.5% or so, and then those were gradually eroded, and it closed out weak with the S&P and the Dow down 1.5%, slightly more on the NASDAQ. Canada down almost 1.5%. In long-dated government bond prices, they were weaker for Germany and Bunds, and slightly firmer here for the U.S. U.S. bonds. U.S. dollar was a little bit easier in here today. The dollar has been steadier overall in this bearish phase for world stock markets, and it appreciated a little bit. Now it's down a little bit against the Aussie here today at 104.03, but you can remember that was up around the 110, 112 area, I believe. Before Wall Street weakened, and it suggests to me that American investors are repatriating some cash from overseas markets. I didn't mention India. India fell fairly sharply here today as well. It's been a soft all week. Got down on the Sensex to 16,000, and then a little bounce off that. and there's some lateral trading at that level, which may hold it up a bit. And elsewhere, in the currencies, mostly range-bound. There's not a great deal going on here, although the big story on the week was the Swiss National Bank's efforts to weaken the Swiss franc. And it's had some real success with that, although the Swiss franc was stronger in here today. So I think the SNB will have to come up with some additional threats or genuine measures to keep the momentum going. And big story on the week, really, it is definitely the big story on the week, is the additional run in gold, and strong again today. It's trading, still trading after hours. It's at 1851.90, so nearly 1852. This morning it was up as high as 1878. Another good day also for platinum, 1877, nearly 78. That's up $30. Palladium's underperforming, 747 down over 9, nearly $10. And silver, the day belonged to silver, up $2.19 as I as I speak, that takes it up to 42.90.05. That's the high of the day, actually, 42.90.05. And what else to mention? Mostly weaker moves for the industrial metals this week. The grain and bean complex been a bit choppy, but mostly steady. Corn is steady in here. So are soybeans. Rough rice is steady. Wheat is the laggard, although it was up in here today. And it's sugar. Sugar has been firm generally. Cotton quietly steady overall. Crude oil. Now this is disappointing because we got if you want to see crude lower to get the commodity inflation under a bit more control. But if you're long crude, you'll be absolutely delighted. And we saw it, the WTI dipped down to 79.17, but then it bounced up and closed at 82.60. And I'll just check the Brent crude, because they had fallen earlier in the week. And again, Brent crude was very similar. Weak early in the day, got down to 105.06. I think that was the low of the week. But then bounced back very strongly, bounced back nearly $4 and closed out at 109. That's up $2 here today. Okay, so what's going on here overall? Well, in terms of global stock markets, it really is hard to argue anything other than it looks very much like a bear market, which is our view and has been our view for a while now. There's nothing that I see of a technical nature that suggests it isn't a bear market. There are some holdouts that haven't fallen to, say, the 20% plus level, but they don't look good, and they are increasingly vulnerable. And then, of course, we've also got the zombie markets, which have been underperforming for the whole period, saw very little recovery following the 2008 and 2009 lows. We've got the absolutely chronic weakness of the banking sector led by the European banks. Europe is still the focal point of concern here, and the action is not good. There's been a lot of condemnation of the Sarkozy-Merkel sort of tête-à-tête, which ended with them recommending a transaction tax on the banks. And that is seen as kind of a political sop, because bank bashing goes down well with electorates. But if your banking sector is reeling, as it is in Europe, I think you don't want to make it even harder for them to make any profits, and that's what the proposal did. I suspect it'll be shot down, but that's the big concern. Now, Europe has a solution to hand, but getting these countries to first appreciate the enormity of the problem, I think a number of them are still in shock mode, and then they kind of hope that it they become inert, hoping that it'll go away. And it's not going away. And the solution that they have is something that really any of us who knew anything about currency unions pointed out way back in the mid to late 1990s, when they were cobbling the whole thing together, that you had to have a a fiscal union as well as a monetary union. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. You wouldn't be able to shift funds around sufficiently among the countries as required, as the U.S. is able to do, as it has a monetary and fiscal union, quite obviously. Now, there were good reasons why they didn't have that fiscal union, and that's because they had a tough enough challenge in getting people to agree to the monetary union, and some countries didn't even get to vote on it, not least Germany. Now, in this crisis environment, they can make a push and really should make a strong push to at least signal intent to go for a complete fiscal union and make that very clear. And I think that would help a lot. But I suspect it'll be a bumpy road in terms of getting there. But that's definitely the direction that they're going in, and that will help a good deal. Meanwhile, you've got an ECB, which is printing money again and buying the sovereign debt of the so-called periphery countries, including Spain and Italy. And part of the solution, of course, of the fiscal union would be a euro bond. So there wouldn't be any more Greek bonds or German bonds or Spanish bonds or Italian bonds. We would just have the euro bonds. And I think we're going to see that, but when? And your guess is as good as mine, but I'll go back to my comment that there'd be a lot of bumps in the road in terms of moving down that path. And governments are crisis-oriented. They kind of had to be dragged kicking and screaming into doing, taking the appropriate action. Now, in terms of this overall bear market for equities, is say that all eyes are focused on Europe, but again, we can already see the solution, and we can see that there's an increasing awareness that people need to go in that direction to correct it. Now, if we go to the United States, we have a very different situation, because in my lifetime of political awareness, which goes back to kind of late childhood, I have never, ever seen the parties divided so much. And when my wife and I moved to London on Boxing Day 1969, I was immediately struck by how divisive politics in the UK were in terms of the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, and they still are. I always used to think, why are we having this? Why don't we have a much more closely allied party system the way the United States did with the Republicans and the Democrats? Well, the Republicans and the Democrats have really gone down the UK route and more, and as I say, I've never seen them more divided and antagonistic than today. And that's about the worst possible environment I feel that you can have, unless one regards it optimistically as some form of sort of creative destruction here, in terms of dealing with the very serious problem of the deficit, the chronically weak economy, and the chronically high unemployment during this very persistent deleveraging phase overall. And I mean, one can be optimistic about that $2 billion cut proposal that they cobbled together with some committee meeting to decide what cuts might actually be made, with the whole thing expiring before anything's really done, before the or it's the nothing will be done until the next election is out of the way. So it's not inconceivable that that election can take place, and then the whole deficit cutting is thrown out the window. And that might well be the case if you see President Obama reelected. Meanwhile, the Republican Party is fielding a number of candidates that, they're way out. Not all of them, but too many of them. Too many of them are. So I apologize for the political comment, but I mentioned that this is relevant to this debate about how the U.S. actually addresses its economic crises, because they're all related. But unemployment, debt deleveraging, deficits, weak growth, so you can't grow out from beneath the deficit. And it's hard to be optimistic about that in the short to medium term. And I know there's a belief that the United States will always prevail in the end and so on, but that's an act of faith. That's kind of, and I think that, again, the problems are real and they're now, and they're not really being addressed in a way that is convincing to investors. Now we then take the growth economies, and they're in the best shape with current account surpluses. They have raised interest rates quite a bit because they have chronic, mostly commodity inflation, although there's some property inflation from in countries like China and Singapore, which they're trying to wring out. But the commodity problem is perhaps the toughest one of all. And when I say it's discouraging to see the crude oil price push back up here today, that just means that it's a little less likely that China and India and the other growth economies will reverse their monetary tightening policies. And China and India are the two most important because they're by far the biggest, and they're the ones that have been most aggressive in terms of their tightening policies, particularly India. And I think there's a risk that growth, a real risk, that growth in those countries will slow faster than the politicians actually think. And there's certainly precedent for that. We can see how quickly the U.S. economy has slowed down from the first quarter GDP. We can see how significant the reductions in estimates are right now. And some of the more conservative economists feel that it's definitely a recession environment. And some of the fund managers coming on CNBC and so on are hopefully saying no, and pointing to the data. And it's been a bit mixed, but it's also lagging data, reflecting what's already happened. And I think the likelihood is that in this third quarter, we're going to see, I'll be surprised if we don't see a slip into the minus GDP level. And I was talking to a friend of mine in Hong Kong here today, and he said Hong Kong's dead. The economy's absolutely flat, and you talk to the retailers, there's almost nothing going on. And I've seen other comments to that effect, and that's usually a pretty vibrant area. The property market is quite weak now, that's a bubble unwinding. We had negative GDP in the last quarter for Hong Kong, and there's every chance that we'll see that again in this quarter, making it a technical recession. So I think what we need to see before too long to prevent a further weakening of global GDP growth is for the growth economies to start reversing their tight monetary policies, but they're going to understandably be very reluctant to do that while the inflation pressures are still high. And if you look at the commodity indices, my favorite is the CCI, because that's the broadest one, the old CRB, which I post quite frequently. It's had a good bounce in here this week. And that's a big concern. So you weigh it all up, and you can see why I'm saying that I don't see anything in terms of either technical evidence or fundamental evidence to suggest that this is anything other than a bear market for equities. Some of the figures I found interesting, I did a few of the percentage calculations here today, and a couple of things that interested me, for instance, some of the BRICS indices had actually peaked in November. That was true of Brazil, for instance, and Brazil is from its November high to its recent low is down 34.6%. That's certainly bear market territory. Russia, which had an April high earlier this year, is down slightly more, 35.3%. Hong Kong had a November last year high as well as Brazil, and that's really the Chinese index that counts in terms of what the non-Chinese citizens get to invest in mainly, the Hang Seng index, and that's down 24.5%. India, I'm surprised this figure wasn't more, but India, again, in November last year high, remember that's when it was quite overextended relative to its rising 200-day moving average, and it was mentioned as such because it was an obvious point. But that's down 24% today. DAX, remember, that was a powerhouse, and everybody was saying, well, Europe's weak except for Germany, and then Germany's GDP growth really slumped on the last set of data, and so did the stock market, and that's down 29.7%. So the old business at the emerging markets are always going to be more risky than the developed country markets, not really being borne out by that example. That's down more than India and Hong Kong, and it's second only to what Brazil and Russia have seen among some of these major markets. UK is down 21.5%. Singapore was down only 15%, but it's still going down. So I didn't do a whole lot more on that. It becomes statistically boring. One gets the idea in seeing that. Okay, so I weigh all that up, and I've described this as or bear markets as a reset, but we need to see the bear market in commodities as well, and it's not happening yet, and some of them have come down, and crude oil is certainly off its highs, but it's still uncomfortably strong overall. And I think that the strength of the precious metals is helping to hold up some of these other commodities. I mean, people just say, well, all right, maybe they don't want to go into gold, but what else is there that they can consider? It's that type of mentality, and therefore we are still in this situation, which I think is one of deteriorating economic data, and that's not going to help the stock market. And that means that everybody says how great the corporate profits are, and they have been great, but they're going to come down. And so we have a cyclical bear market here in equities. I think that's clearly evident. And in the West, at any rate, that cyclical bear market is taking place within the long-term confines of a secular valuation contraction. I've talked about that before on a number of occasions, but it's the sort of thing that I cut my teeth on in Wall Street coming in the mid-1960s and thinking that stock markets could only go up because Wall Street had a generation of just a strong secular bull market. And then it just flatlined with some scary bear market declines, not least the 73-74 period, and valuations contracted until 1982. And anybody who bought in 1982 or 1983, I mean, that was just the absolute classic buy and hold environment, even right through the 1987 crash and other problems and banking crises that occurred, as you never get away from the business cycle as well. It was a great period, and markets will get back to that, but maybe not for another 5 to 10 years, depending on how long this valuation contraction bear, which began in 2000, how long that persists in the West. So my point in bringing that up on this occasion is twofold. One, the estimates on earnings are quite good, and as I emphasize, corporations have done exceptionally well. And I've often cautioned against being against being too bearish as a consequence of the economic problems. Over the years, I've pointed that out, saying that because, of course, one buys the companies. Russell Napier said it best when he paraphrased Clinton and said, "It's not about the economy, stupid," meaning that people buy stocks. But those earnings estimates, to repeat myself, are too high for the third and fourth quarters of this year. And the stock markets are beginning to reflect that, I believe, but probably almost certainly have further to go in reflecting that. And then additionally, David, what's your point? They have yet to reflect that, but then also because of the valuation contraction in the West, we're going to see the valuations not just become attractive once again, but they're probably on their way back to becoming super attractive. But what that means, that's good news when they are super attractive, and you just get into a classic buy and hold environment. But what it also means is that markets can go to very attractive multiples and then or valuations in general, and then not do a whole lot. But all the time, you have yields moving up, and you have hopefully enough growth to keep multiples down and to enable those dividends to go up. I think that will happen, but it's not Goldilocks, folks. That's a point to take away on this. Now, where are we in this bearish cycle here? And that's a tough guess, but my hope is that we've seen the worst of it already. But I honestly don't know, and neither does anyone else here. And I would feel better about it if I could see some breaks in the logjam that I've talked about that would indicate that Asian central banks in particular were going back into a more stimulative mode, because I'm not sure who's going to be first in terms of doing something that actually improves confidence. And that can happen very quickly as people realize that they've you can't just stand there and watch this, and they do have to do something. And there we are. Now, therefore, I'm not rushing in to buy anything, but I am certainly thinking about it, and part of the thinking about it process involves all those reviews that Owen is doing of these high-yielding equities. And the higher those yields go, the more tempting those purchases will be. I won't go for the highest yields overall, because there'll be some companies that may be strictly local in terms of their activities are primarily within one country, and the country's not doing terribly well. Well, those high yields are vulnerable. They can be reduced. So I will be looking very much among the multinationals, and I've already mentioned that energy's the sector I like. And you know, and we're seeing an increasing number of yields in the 5 to 7% area. And just to flip back and look at some of those things that Owen has done, and just this month alone, he's covered a lot of them. And you can check those if you didn't see them the first time around. Okay, what about these precious metals here overall? Well, I've written a lot about this, so I'm not going to spend a huge time here in talking about it, especially as I've spent so much time talking about stock markets. But gold is overextended, but it's also very much in form, and it has a self-feeding momentum going for it right now. The more overextended it gets, of course, the more susceptible it becomes to the next corrective phase, and that's nothing to panic about. And particularly if you're holding a bullion fund, I wouldn't worry about it that much at all. But reversions to the mean take place regularly, and that's a healthy corrective process overall. A lot of people are looking at the same, well, anybody who's really interested in gold is looking at similar charts to what we keep producing on the yellow metal, and they're starting to diversify a little bit more. And certainly in the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've seen them diversifying into platinum, and silver had been creeping up again. Remember, silver had a downside key day reversal earlier in the month. So did gold, but silver had the bigger key day reversal. Gold shrugged its key off almost immediately. Silver didn't, and it held it up for, it's until today. And this $2 plus, $2.25 move closing on the highs for silver has enabled it to break up out of that range. And while the game is still on, in other words, while these markets are still in form, silver may be the best bet, and platinum may be the next best bet. Palladium, I mentioned in my review that it was lagging in here, and when I look at that chart of palladium, I am concerned. I thought late in July, it was looking okay. It was testing the high again, but then it had another big downward dynamic. And you look at the trading range for palladium, whether you look at a daily chart or a weekly chart, and one should really look at both, and it's had some, particularly the weekly chart, that's the best one to look at, and it's had some thumping big downward dynamics off the higher side of that range. I don't like that type of activity, and I think that there's the reason for that is almost certainly that its main usage is in the catalytic converters, although it has a jewelry usage as well. But you know, people aren't stockpiling it the way they're buying gold and silver. And most people would agree with my view that silver is high beta, gold. So if I was going to buy one precious metal here, and although I'm not wanting to do a whole lot here as I monitor all these fast-changing developments, if I were going to buy any precious metal in here next week, it would be silver, and I may well do that as well, despite the fact that I'm going to take a few days holiday quite soon as well. Okay, what else to mention? Currencies. I think we'll just get more, more ranging. I think the case for Japan doing something to weaken the yen is becoming stronger and stronger. But the central bank governor, in my opinion, privately, and he's not even able to disguise this publicly very well, is, in my opinion, very pleased to have a strong yen. And at least he can claim that he's preserving the purchasing power of Japanese citizens, but it certainly is hammering those export companies, and it will lead to a further hollowing out of the Japanese economy, because they'll have to move offshore to offset the damage that this very strong yen is causing. So I would expect there to be, sooner or later, more pressure on them to do something to try to weaken the Japanese yen. And I think a dollar collapse, which I've never really believed in, as you know, although it's a theme that people talk about regularly, I just don't think it's going to happen. And I don't see the evidence that it's going to happen here on the chart. And actually, the dollar has steadied up against a number of currencies against which it had been very weak. Okay. Crude oil, I've covered. I think fundamentally there's a pretty good case for saying that crude ought to be $10 to $15 lower, particularly the Brent. Even though we have this tight supply situation with the Libyan production down, and the Libyan production is going to stay down for quite a while, unfortunately. But we see some demand destruction. China, incidentally, is the biggest energy or oil importer, and but even its demand is, I think, slowing a bit. It certainly is in the United States, and then we get all these expensive subsidized renewables in here, which are making inroads into the oil market in terms of demand. They certainly won't help us with our electricity bills and our gas bills and our gasoline bills. They're going up very sharply, and that's another deflationary. It's an inflationary and deflationary hit. Because it's eroding our purchasing power, and it is taking money away from other forms of consumption. Okay, I think I've gone on too long on this. There are many more things that I could talk about, but then, hey, there's always next week, and I've got to give you people a bit of respite here. So, have a fantastic weekend. All the best.